We're going to call the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February 17th. We currently have the Department of Public Safety coming in to chat with us. Members, this is an oversight hearing, and we're going to ask that you ask questions as we go so we don't get too far off of the subject. With that, Commissioner Campion, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you. Michael Campion, Commissioner of Public Safety. With me is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner. Madam Chair, how much time do you have?
All day.
Which is 4 hours?
An hour and a half.
Hour and a half. Well, we'll get right into it. We'll try to be brief and concise and to the point. My understanding is that there are some other departments in state government that have a mandatory report that they have to issue each year that has to do with performance measures. The Department of Public Safety, my understanding a number of years ago, had such a requirement and now specifically does not. We have three initiatives that we initiated some 5 years ago when we got to the commissioner's office in January of 2004 that I think are germane to what the committee has an interest in going over today. I'll go over them very, very quickly. We instituted a leadership style that has core values. Those core values are ethics. Obviously, to exemplify the highest standards of the organization, leadership has to certainly embrace and personally and professionally operate with the highest integrity possible. The idea of a visionary leadership, see the possibilities while still grounded where we are today and convey and communicate both possibilities and expectations to others in an organization. An orientation to the future, respect where we are now, the present and the past, but have the intellectual curiosity to seek new and innovative ideas to present day problems. Some of that is the use of technology, which we've implemented in public safety here over the last number of years. A couple of examples, very brief examples, we've paid for and implemented and rolled out a new automated fingerprint identification system, I think from $10 or $12 million project to analyze and house fingerprints and to provide a reduced response time for when an individual is booked, those prints go into a system and they are turned around and positive identification on a biometrical basis is provided to the local unit of government, that local booking station. It used to take, a couple of years ago, it used to take a couple of months. Prior to this new system, it took 2 or 3 hours. Now it takes probably less than 3 or 4 minutes. Another example has been
Mr. Campion, I just want to officially call the committee to order. We do now have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's certainly a number of other examples. The Fire Marshal's Office implemented a fire incident reporting system, which allows for some 200 incident reports annually to be categorized and put in a data system. Alcohol and gambling has reduced the turnaround time from 60 to 90 days for regulatory and civil background checks. There's any number of different examples of the use of technology that has been implemented in public safety the last number of years. And probably the last and most important core value that we have tried to implement, and that is the relationships and partnerships that we've tried to build throughout the wide spectrum of stakeholders that we service. The idea that respect for others and to have effective and diverse communication with any number of different stakeholders. We've done it by traveling around the state. We attend any multitude of functions, conferences and meetings and any number of different forums where stakeholders get together on an annual or semi-annual basis. We try to instill that in our division directors and certainly in the commissioner's office. The second thing we tried to do very, very early on, was institute the concept of legacy issues. Instead of just trying to come up with solutions for today or tomorrow or this legislative session or even a year, but to challenge division directors in the commissioner's office to identify those issues that will have an impact on public safety 5 and 10 years from now, and to look really kind of long-term and identify what those issues are and to raise the standard, I think, kind of high. A couple of real brief examples, the radio system that has been promoted and implemented and funded by this body and others at the legislature. I think people 10 years from now will be thankful that project was initiated and completed. The DVS infrastructure system, it's a 20-plus-year-old system, a computer system that's been put together with to barely keep things together. that this legislature funded it last year, and in the next 4 years we're going to roll out a system that we will be very pleased, and the people of Minnesota will be very pleased that we have for the next 20 years. The institution of a fire safety account to fund fire, a number of different fire activities around the state of Minnesota, increased public safety in the fire area, been a very successful initiative. The BCA building a number of years ago is a state-of-the-art facility, particularly its laboratory. I think it's as good as any laboratory in the country, and again, the legislature should be pleased and proud of that. I mentioned the IRFA system. That will serve Minnesotans for the next 15 to 20 years. PFAP consolidation initiative that we have in front of us, I think will serve and provide great efficiency and effectiveness. And shudder, some people might shudder, but I personally look at the primary seatbelt. We get that passed. There will be people that will be living today that wouldn't be otherwise if we didn't pass it. The other third and final thing that we try to do with public safety is to compare ourselves to other states, particularly other states in our region. We have learned from other states. We judge ourselves in some measure by our progress compared to other states. The CrimNet, or what is now the Minnesota Justice Information Service System, has been a model for the country. There are any number of different states that have come to Minnesota to find out what we do here and how we've been able to accomplish things. The radio system is another enterprise that others around the country have come to Minnesota to seek how we've been able to put together the governors, the governance, and how we've been able to succeed and bring local units to government together to move this entire enterprise forward. The Crime Alert Network is a small but a very important alert system at the BCA. Any number of states have come here to find out how we've done that. Emergency management practices, our Homeland Security Emergency Management Division has been one that other states have come to Minnesota to see how we've done things, participated in our training, and any number of other learning opportunities in that particular area. So that's a very, very, very brief overview of a very complex agency that touches almost anything that we do here in Minnesota that has to do with the safety of citizens and communities. So with that, I would like to turn some of the rest of the presentation over to Mary Ellison, the Deputy Commissioner, and I would also, Madam Chair, members state that we have any number of division directors here that can answer some of the questions that members might have.
Mr. Campion, I actually have a question first. You had stated that your agency isn't required to do any of the reports that it used to be. I actually have gotten a couple of copies of the report. Do you think that those reports are helpful to the legislature in making, you know, policy decisions about what you should or how you are doing or not doing in achievement of your goals? Mr. Campion?
Madam Chair, to be honest with you, I don't know. I think you and members would be better to answer that. We certainly be more than willing to do anything that we're directed to do. I think that the legislature and these committees drill down pretty well in terms of what we're doing and how we are using our resources. So whether an additional report, mandatory report every year would be helpful, if it is, we'd be more than happy to do it.
All right. And then the second thing is I actually have a copy of the office memorandum that was sent from the Minnesota Department of Finance and Employee Relations talking about comprehensively assessing your programs and services. And one of the key goals in this year's budget document was to increase the emphasis on linkages to statewide and agency strategic goals, and specifically talking about key goals, and then also key measures, introduce or update key performance measures, trends, and why they are important to the agency's management. Do you believe that you have that within the budget document? This isn't the budget committee, this is a policy committee, so we're supposed to look at, you know, your mission and those kinds of things. Do you believe that that is in your budget document, Mr. Campion?
Madam Chair, members, yes, I think so. You may have to cherry pick and search a bit, but I think yes, and I think that we today we'll pull together the information that that you and members here are looking for.
Great, thank you, Ms. Ellison.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I've done today is to identify 10 different ways that we measure best practices. or make every attempt to ensure best practices in the Department of Public Safety. You certainly will see some of these in the budget books. You'll see some of them in other documents that we prepare. And so let me just start by saying, first and foremost, one of the simplest ways to measure performance is to measure outputs, or, you know, what do we do and who do we do it for? So to give you some examples of the things that we look for in the department, the BCA examined 19,962 cases in 2008, which is a 40% increase over 4 years ago. There are 150 agencies that receive funding to serve crime victims, and we keep track of who is served and how they're served, and last year they provided services to 107,000 individuals statewide. 480 fire investigations were conducted by the State Fire Marshal's Office in 2008, and 25% of those were arson. 3,500 inspections were completed by Deputy State Fire Marshals last year. 798 different brand styles of fire standard compliant cigarettes are currently certified by the State Fire Marshal's Office. That was a legislative initiative a couple of years ago, and we've been successful at implementing that. In the Homeland Security Emergency Management Area, there have been 20 presidential declarations of disasters in the last 12 years, with $34 million in federal and state disaster monies distributed in the past 2 years. We've had 83 emergency management classes and 17 school safety classes, and there were 29,000 student contact hours in those classes. There were over 2,000 activities in the emergency management area which were evaluated, with only 4 areas needing re-demonstration. And we have already re-demonstrated 3 out of those 4, and the 4th re-demonstration is planned for August 4th. We've reduced the response time for fingerprint identification and updating of criminal histories from 2 hours to 3.5 minutes. We received, as Commissioner Campion noted, we received more than 157,000 fingerprint cards in 2007, and more than 98% were submitted via 168 electronic fingerprint monitoring devices. That was another legislative proposal that we had a couple of years ago that was successful. This has meant a great deal of increased efficiency for the criminal justice system. We maintain and monitor 20,775 predatory offender registrants. We implemented a state lottery sweepstakes campaign, and we've received 40,000 complaints so far of internet fraud. We have 1,800 individuals each year that apply for reparations, and we distribute $3.1 million to those crime victims and their families through money that was awarded both by the state and federal government. Minnesota State Patrol, although not within this committee's jurisdiction, it's interesting to note that they have 578,211 enforcement contacts and investigated 20,953 crashes and made 6,495 DWI arrests last year. Another way that we try to ensure best practices is one thing to measure outputs, what we're doing and who we're doing it for, but to look at some key outcomes. The number of deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled on Minnesota highways was 0.89 in 2007, as compared to 1.28 in 1997. There's been a 12-fold increase in seatbelt use in the past 30 years in Minnesota. The average number of fire-related deaths in Minnesota per year has dropped from 78 in the decade of the 1980s to 47 per year since the year 2000. The number of significant pipeline incidents that we responded to was 4 in 2007. One of the things that we measure is it's important to get money out to local units of government and not-for-profits in an expedient manner, so we measure the amount of contracts that we're able to process within 30 days. All state agencies, this is another budget or a legislative policy initiative requiring state agencies to have emergency management certification. As of now, all state agencies have complied with the new emergency management certification training statute that was implemented. 3 weeks after implementing a new law that required jails to incorporate a check of the predatory offender database, we were able to locate 28 non-compliant sex offenders, again within 3 weeks. The compliance rate for sex offender registration, which is a key measure of public safety, we believe in the state of Minnesota, is currently at 93%. Mr. Campion mentioned the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. We literally have hundreds of stories of crimes that have been solved as a result of this network. Since 2006, 7 individuals have been indicted for their connection in the deaths of 3 separate people as a result of the Cold Case Unit. The Cold Case Unit was something that was funded a few years ago. by the state legislature.
Excuse me, Ms. Ellison. Representative Paymar.
I'm just trying to follow along here. What documents are we going on? And is there an actual report that we're supposed to be looking at, or just the 1996 agency performance report? I have no idea where we are.
Representative Paymar, actually, there was not anything submitted to the committee. We did our best to put some things together so that you would have something to look at.
So you're just presenting to us.
Is that a question?
Yeah.
Ms. Ellison.
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, our understanding was that we were to come today to give testimony on how we ensure best practices within the Department of Public Safety. That was our understanding of what we were to do today. The performance report that is in front of you used to be a statutory requirement, but is no longer.
Representative Paymar. Ms. Ellison.
Another outcome measure that I would point to is the success of the 800 megahertz communication system during the 2007 bridge collapse. A third way that we measure our look at best practices is to conduct surveys. The Crime Victim Reparations Program conducts surveys of people that have utilized their service in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Uses surveys of police agencies that utilize their service and gathers information on the different programs that they operate and whether or not they're helpful. As another way that we use to monitor our programs is to do selected evaluations of programs as funding permits. There's not always funding available to do evaluation, but we have been able to hire evaluators within the Office of Justice Programs to conduct selected evaluations of different crime victim programs. We provide evaluation training for our grantees, so we have people, you know, come in to evaluation sessions and learn about how to measure their program success and really how to demonstrate outcomes. We develop evaluation tip sheets for our grantees, so again, information that they can use to successfully evaluate their programs.
Excuse me, Ms. Ellison, if you develop that for people that you give a grant to, what is it that you think that we, the legislature, should use then to evaluate what you're doing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would certainly think it's important for you to look at the budget book that is prepared. It's certainly, I understand this is not the budget committee, but certainly there are some key measures in there, largely output measures, but those are things that you could look at. You could also, and oftentimes this happens when we drill down into specific divisions work, if you wanted to, for instance, one of the issues is the Department of Public Safety is so broad and diverse. So, for instance, if you had a particular interest in crime victim programs, we certainly could come forward and talk more specifically about how we evaluate them, what kind of outcomes we're finding, how many programs there are, what kind of reports they're producing, or, for instance, if you had information specifically that you wanted on fire investigations and what would be the best practices for eliminating fire in the state of Minnesota, we certainly could come forward with that. We do, you know, we prepare certain material that we always send to the legislature, but frankly, most often, I think you receive so much information that people don't always read the information that is provided and so end up having perhaps more questions. Another example would be if you're interested in the work of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, if you wanted a more overall presentation and had some specific questions, we certainly could address any specific questions that you have. I mean, those are the things that I would say would be helpful. It's difficult with an agency as broad to say this is what we do with every division because we really look at each division separately in terms of how they measure their outcomes. How we measure fire deaths is different than how we measure the impact of a program that serves crime victims.
So do you currently have performance measures then for each department within the Department of Public Safety? And if so, then, you know, how long have you had them? When did you develop them? How do you review whether they're accurate or not or effective in measuring? Ms. Ellison.
Madam Chair, which division would you like me to start with?
Well, Ms. Ellison, we have the charge to, you know, to do oversight over the department, and I could have, you know, specifically picked or chose, you know, one particular department, but I kind of was hoping that you could, you know, enlighten us. Many other departments, mm-hmm. for example, the Department of Transportation, the Department of, what else? the DNR, while they are not mandated to have these measures, they actually have a very effective tool that people can at least look at and understand whether or not there are targets and whether or not they're meeting them. And so I guess my question is, do you have such?
Madam Chair, we do have targets, and we do have expectations of each of our divisions. For instance, let me take the Fire Marshal's office. I mean, one of the ways that we measure our outcomes is certainly the number of fire investigations that are completed, the number of investigations that aren't successful, and then what's done with those reports to improve the safety of a particular facility, whether that be a public facility or a private facility. We look at the number of fire-related deaths. We look at the cause of the death and whether there are certain measures that we could take to reduce certain causes of death. In the area of Office of Traffic Safety, we look at federal data. We look at seatbelt use because we know the more people that use seatbelts, the fewer deaths there are and the less costly the injuries are that result from those traffic crashes. So we keep charts of the number of people that use seatbelts and do surveys, you know, out in the field and measure the number of people using seatbelts. We look at the number of crashes per vehicle miles traveled. That's a pretty standard measurement throughout the country. So for every 100,000 miles traveled, how many fatalities do we have and how do we compare to other states and what are they doing to lower those crashes? And so, for instance, within the state patrol, if they see that there's a particular area of our trunk highway system that has a high number of crashes per vehicle miles traveled, then we know we need to deploy more resources towards that particular goal. In the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, certainly one of the important things is lab turnaround time. So we set goals for the amount of time that we would like to have pass between the time a sample comes in and the time the results go out. And so we try to maintain a certain number of days for turnaround time. In terms of predatory offender registration, we look at the number of people that are compliant with Minnesota's laws. And when we find that we have a higher noncompliance rate, then a couple of years ago we instituted a process where we got some grant money from the state to actually hire some extra help at the local level to track down predatory offenders, find out where they are, and increase our compliance rate. In the Office of Justice Programs, we look at, certainly for battered women shelters, the number of people served, the number of women served, the number of children served, the cost of that service, the number of days that people are in the shelter. Our grantees use surveys of their victims and say, you know, was the service that you provided helpful and how is it helpful? We look at that data and try to use that to improve the services that our grantees are offering. So those are some examples.
Representative Bingham. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess what I don't understand is kind of off of what Sheriff Haymar said is if you use different elements for best practices from fire safety to traffic to the BCA to your Office of Justice Programs, why wouldn't you come in and you think that you could bring through every department or every group and go through that? Why wouldn't you have prepared for that today?
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, because I wasn't told that I was supposed to have a document prepared ahead of time. So I was told that the subject of today's hearing was to come and talk about how we ensure best practices within the Department of Public Safety. And so I prepared 10 different ways that we ensure best practices and try to incorporate as much as I could out of the budget book and other information that's been provided to the legislature, and then we have our division directors here to answer specific questions. But if you would like me to put it in writing, I would be happy to do that.
That would be great. All right. Please continue.
Development of standards of best practice. The 911 program has a strict set of rules on how the 911 fee can be used to ensure the integrity of the system. The Office of Justice Programs has developed and implemented standards for the operation of narcotics task forces and crime victim programs. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Forensic Science Laboratory has strict quality control procedures that they utilize. Alcohol and gambling enforcement is working with the liquor industry to establish appropriate strategies to address the internet sale of liquor. We prepare a document within the Office of Justice Programs called Snapshots on Youth Issues, which identify best practices in working with youth who are at risk of engaging in risky behavior. We use site visits and desk audits. We have requirements in terms of the numbers of site visits that staff are to conduct with our grantees. We also do random desk audits, so if a grantee submits their information and we feel that we want to check further, we have them submit all of the backup documentation to justify the funds that they've requested to our state agency. We use oversight committees. Each county board of commissioners has to establish a committee to develop a 911 plan for the county, thereby setting the proper procedures to best meet the needs of the 911 system within that particular county. The BCA has the Forensic Science Advisory Board to provide input on laboratory best practices. The Minnesota Fraud Enforcement Partnership was established as a public-private partnership to address internet fraud. Homeland Security and Emergency Management has an oversight committee to provide input on best practices in the emergency management area. The Fire Services Advisory Committee provides input to the Fire Marshal's Office. Another way that we ensure best practices, and Commissioner Campion touched on that, is membership in national organizations. Chris Ide, our Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, serves as Chair of the Policy Oversight Committee on the National Emergency Assistance Compact Organization. Colonel Mark Danaski serves as President of the National Organization of State and Provincial Police. DBS Director Pat McCormick serves as a board member of the Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. Our Office of Justice Programs Director, Gary Bolvera, serves as a member of the National Criminal Justice Association. Our State Fire Marshal, Jerry Rosendahl, is a board member of the National Association of State Fire Marshals. Superintendent Tim O'Malley of the BCA serves as treasurer of the Association of State Crime Investigative Agencies. Of course, we aren't able, we have lots of travel restrictions right now, but just being members of those associations provides us information for what people are thinking across the country in like-minded agencies in terms of best practices, what they've tried that has worked and not worked, and so forth. Another way we ensure best practices is accreditation and national recognition. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Forensic Science Laboratory is accredited through the American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors. So they have a laboratory accreditation board, and they come and make sure that the practices within our facility are what they should be. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was one of four laboratories chosen by the FBI to be a regional mitochondrial DNA laboratory. That was a tremendous success and exemplifies the good practices that they have. Scott Wiggins, Director of the Emergency Communications Network Division, is regularly asked to present at national groups regarding the Minnesota 800 megahertz system and our governance structure and how we were able to achieve that governance structure.
If I could ask about the 800 megahertz, do you have any measures for the 800 megahertz to know if, you know, you are kind of proceeding down the path of success? Or, you know, I carried that bill, so I've been a very strong supporter of the proposal, but to make certain that we actually are achieving what it is that we set out to do.
Madam Chair, we do have many of those measures, and we can get those to you in detail. I have a brochure on it. I have the budget documents. Mr. Wiggins would certainly be willing to come by and talk about how far along we are with the 800 megahertz and give you the report on the both the bridge collapse and the Republican National Convention were really good examples of the 800 megahertz system working the way it was designed to work. So,
okay. Ms. Austin.
Finally, the last area that I was mentioning are just lean processes. The Department of Administration has been active in developing for agencies the ability to do a lean process, which is really to drill down and look at specific processes and look where there's opportunities for really streamlining those processes. And within the Department of Public Safety, we've completed the lean process on contracts, how we produce contracts, and then how we produce grants. So it takes the people that are the people working on the front lines doing these practices day to day, takes them out of their work for a week and says, okay, let's outline the whole practice that we have and look for duplication, look for ways to save money, look for ways to really reduce the administrative burden on those processes. So we've completed two of those. They've been very successful in eliminating some duplication of effort. Also within our driver vehicle services system, as Commissioner Campion mentioned, because of the legislature addressing this issue, we were able to get some money for redesigning our entire DVS information system. But as part of that, we are literally mapping every single process that we use within the driver vehicle services and looking for ways to streamline each and every practice and get it ready for more electronic processing and just better business practices as we move into the future.
Okay.
So those are 10 overall ways that we ensure best practices. We have division directors here. We can answer any specific questions that people would have on programs.
Representative Bingham. Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have three separate questions on three things that I always like to follow. One are the task force, whether it's the gang task force, financial crime task force. My question is, and I think I asked this in Representative Tamar's committee too, but, you know, as cities are also feeling budget problems, part of the deal with these task forces is that the local units either offer up one of their officers, and so it is kind of a burden on them too. So I'm wondering, have you been in contact or have you are these task force fully staffed? Have you been told that maybe they're going to be paring back, not going to participate anymore?
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, I attended the Gang and Oversight Council meeting 3 weeks ago. Had an elongated discussion with the people that were there. Gave them an idea of what we thought might take place at the legislature. Talked about the prospects of some of the federal money through burn grant monies that may be available today. We don't even know for sure how much money and what the restrictions on the burn grant money, for instance, are. There is a very strong desire for, I know, part of local units of government, local law enforcement, that public safety advocates strongly for funding at the legislature, which we said that we would, I think evidenced by the fact it was the governor's budget. There's concern always that if there is not a certain level of funding, that the local units of government might have to cut back, yes. But they're optimistic, they're hopeful, and we think we're poised to be in as good a position as we can be as we go forward with this legislative process.
Representative Bingham, thank you. Comment on that, then I'll go to my next question. My concern is that, in general, is that something that may need a dollar's worth of investment to only get a penny, I think, and I'm glad to hear that, you know, that it sounds like people are going to continue with it, but it's just that we want to make sure we're getting our best bang for our buck for the task force, which do good work. The next question is, and I know I think we share the same desire to get this moving, is the being able to use credit cards at the DMV satellites. This is a consumer-friendly thing, but it's something that I think has been tied up in legislation. I know the chair has done legislation on it, and I was just wondering, when are we going to be able to get this undone so that we can allow consumers to be able to get their tags and license plates and renew their driver's license with a little bit more convenience?
Madam Chair, as soon as Visa changes its rules is really the short answer. I don't think anybody's more frustrated with this credit card issue than we are. Visa, we issued a report. Visa basically controls the market. Most people have Visa credit cards, and they refuse to allow an exception for charging a convenience fee on every single transaction. So, for instance, if you go to a Target store, everybody's paying basically a convenience fee in the form of higher prices so that people can use credit cards. It's invisible to the consumer. But here in government, we don't want to have people that don't use their credit card pay a convenience fee for the benefit of those people who do use a credit card. So we have been at this now for 3 years, that at least that I've been involved, trying to find a suitable solution. And we thought we were making some progress with Visa in that they were going to allow an exception, and they decided not to allow an exception. So the credit card report has a couple of different options. One is to just allow MasterCard and Discover Card only. I can't remember what the second option is, but those would be some options that wouldn't serve all of the public, but certainly would serve more people than we're serving now.
Representative Bingham? Okay, comment, and I'll be into my last question, Madam Chair. I would like to maybe explore that if we do have some time, because I do think it's an important issue. It's one of those things that, as you're going through the grocery store, that people come by and say, hey, I have a meaning to email you, and, you know, something, you know, that about the inconvenience. The other question I have is, do you pair up with the Department of Corrections, or do you meet with the Department of Corrections over some of what I see, some overlap in programming, especially with the Office of Justice? Some of the programs that grants that are administered and some of the programming that the Department of Corrections does are very similar.
So what I'm wondering is, do you ever sit down with Commissioner Fabian and look at kind of the, I guess the overlapping, and to see which does, you know, whether it's our Office of Justice programming or whether it's our government programming that does a better job, more efficient job. I'm just wondering if you have conversations or is that...
Deputy Commissioner Allison.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, let me start, and then Commissioner Campion probably has even more experience, but certainly within the Office of Justice program today, we have several areas of overlap. We actually have a staff person that we have assigned to corrections to do end-of-confinement review hearings and to work on victim issues within the Department of Corrections. We have cross-training. We have some of our OJP staff that actually serve on some of those end-of-confinement review committees. So we have a really good relationship in terms of the victim area. Gary Bovera, our director of OJT, has been very instrumental in working with the Department of Corrections on release grants, and we work with, I'm trying to think of the name of the release grants, but the reentry grants, applying for grants together and jointly working on programs because it involves both the prison system and not-for-profit agencies that we serve through our agency. We work together with the Department of Corrections on the a deck of playing cards that have pictures of cold cases on them. So we work in cooperation with the Department of Corrections to use those playing cards and their pictures and a little case example of the different cold cases that can be shown to people within the prison system to see if anybody has any leads on any of those cold cases. Those are the examples I think of right off the top of my head, but you might have others.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I don't know if I have too much more to add than that. I'm pretty regular contact with Commissioner Fabian. If there's other ideas we explore, we do that, and we've joined together on some other adventures over the years, and I'm sure we'll continue to do so, try to look for efficiency.
All right. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Ellison and Commissioner. I share Representative Bingham's concern about the question with the driver's license. I've received several inquiries too. I encourage the department to work with several of us to try to resolve that. I think it's incumbent upon us to take the lead here in finding ways. Maybe if it requires enabling legislation to lower the cost of those licenses or tabs, or I don't know exactly what all is included. Certainly the tabs are a question. To lower those prices in order to accommodate an incentive for them to go that way, and then the ultimate savings that would result, I would expect, would be substantial. So I encourage you to work with us in that. Look forward to us resolving that. Two questions. The first one is they're all rather specific. The first one will be a somewhat a hybridized question, and that the first part being. Ms. Ellison, you mentioned the Crime Victims Division and that they help programs with women and children. I'm assuming they also help with men, too? Okay. The other question, other part of that question was related to the graph that we have on page 2 of 6 of one of the publications here dealing with seatbelt use. And we can see that seatbelt use has increased in Minnesota steadily over the past decade, about 2 or 2.25% increase per year. The projections are in calendar year 08, or were in calendar year 08, of 91%. I'd be curious what you found the actuals to be, and then what your projections are for the trends in that area for the future. What might be your projection for next calendar year?
Commissioner Campion, I just wanted to let you know that we actually printed off the document from Accountability Minnesota to give to the members so they had something to look at. So that's what he's referring to.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative. 87% compliance was the last actual hard survey that was done. That's the latest information that we have on seatbelt compliance. What's projected, I think the last 13% is a difficult... if that's your question, I think it is. To try to get that last 13% in compliance is very difficult. We look again to other states and what their experience has been. I think there's 26 states that have that law, and their experience has been that last group, the last 10-15% has been influenced in large measure by a primary seatbelt law. there's still going to be 3-4% probably that will not comply with that. That's other, again, other states' experience. I think Washington, Michigan, for instance, are like at 97, 96, 90, hover in that area. Right, so there'll always be a couple percentage of people that won't wear a seatbelt. But generally speaking, states that have passed that law have seen compliance increase somewhere around 10% to 12%, depending on where the compliance rate was before the law was passed.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Ms. Ellison. The last question is one dealing with the alcohol and gambling enforcement. I'm curious, with our Indian casinos, curious to know about the success that we've had, the level of inspections that we have in regard to the compact. Also wondering if some of the financial aspects of the casinos are part of the compact, and whether we've been measuring, taking a look at their books as we go into there. Is there somebody who could answer those questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Kelsey, I'm going to have John Willems, the Director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, answer that question.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Willems, spelled W-I-L-L-E-M-S, and I am the Director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. There are two parts to this question, Madam Chair, members of the committee, representatives. The first had to do with inspections, I believe, and the second had to do with review of financial paperwork, if I understand that. The first one is that we do periodic random unannounced inspections of machines within the state of Minnesota. We try to hit each property within Minnesota several times throughout the year. That count of machines varies from any given moment of time, but runs somewhere in excess of 20,000 games. And we do try to inspect them to ensure compliance with the technical standards of those agreements. However, there is absolutely no way we can inspect every machine within the state of Minnesota. So given that limitation, we do what we can under the terms of the compact relative to inspection. The second thing is that the aspects related under the compact infer that two things. One, that the tribe shall perform an annual audit of their gaming facilities, and that the audit may be reviewed by the department. We do that periodically. We schedule times. It's probably been about 18 months now since we've gone through the audits. We review those to ensure generally that they are done, and to just review the general documentation that's contained within them. Apart from that, there's really no standard that the audit itself is defined inside of the compact that it must have.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Willems? Willems. Just to follow up, would you say that we are meeting the expectations of the compact in those two areas, in the equipment certification and in the audits, the financial audits? And the second part of that follow-up is, are those financial audits available to Minnesotans?
Mr. Wong.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, representative, the answer is that we could always do more in relation to inspections, given the fact that we can't hit every machine. But there are a number of regulatory processes involved with that. There is the testing and approval of the machines through the independent testing lab before they're certified for use in the state. The tribal government does provide some additional regulatory function over that, and in fact, in the context of Minnesota, is the primary regulatory authority, as inferred through the compact. And then there is oversight by a number of federal agencies as well. So in spite of our inability to get to every game, I think there is reasonably effective oversight over tribal gaming, and in 2005 or 6, the Office of the Legislative Auditor came to the same conclusion in reviewing the program, while recognizing that we had a number of issues that we needed to work on. The second question is whether or not those documents are open to the general public, and the answer is the department was party to some litigation a number of years ago over those documents. The department does not retain those documents. It reviews them at tribal offices. So to the degree that Minnesotans had access to tribal records, the answer would be determined by their Freedom of Information Act and how it applies to that.
Thank you. Commissioner Ellison, I have a follow-up question for a comment. This is Commissioner Ellison. You made reference to using lean performance measures. Does this mean that you are actively using a quality improvement tool like Six Sigma or Lean? And if so, how many management staff are certified? How does the department see using Lean or Six Sigma to its best fit and benefit of the department?
Madam Chair, we have one person who is Lean certified within the Department of Public Safety. I'm trying to remember the other questions. We've used it currently on two different processes. We certainly will be, I don't have any knowledge of any immediate plans to use it with other processes. We have found it to be very helpful, and certainly would use it as indicated or as is appropriate.
Okay. All right. Other questions? Representative West. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question for either Commissioner Campion or Assistant Commissioner Ellison. Well, I guess I'll ask both of you first. Were you with Department of Public Safety or any variation department within that in the early 90s? Either of you?
We're both division directors. Madam Chair, Representative, we're both division directors within the Department of Public Safety in the 90s.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you both recall when Governor Carlson at the time asked the State Patrol to do some extra details in the city of Minneapolis?
Madam Chair, Representative West, yes, we do.
Okay.
Representative West.
Madam Chair, and to both the testifiers, do you anticipate, based on what look to be substantial cuts for local law enforcement in Minnesota based on the governor's presented budget, that there will be any additional help forthcoming in that way in the upcoming budget cycle?
Commissioner Campion.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesher, would be my understanding that for something similar to take place today that took place under Governor Carlson's watch would require governor's action. Literally. I don't know that we could deploy state troopers over to City of Minneapolis without the City of Minneapolis requesting, for instance. And I haven't had no discussions with the governor about that up to this point in time. We have, I think we have, the governor in public safety has a track record of being willing to do those kinds of things, but it wouldn't be my, within my authority to say that's what would take place. Not trying to not answer your question, but I think it would require some action on the part of the governor to take those kinds of measures.
Assistant Commissioner Allison.
Madam Chair, Representative Rush, the other thing I would say is that we're still trying to get the details on the stimulus package, but from the little that I know, it looks like there will be funding going directly to certain larger cities for police activities. So as those details roll out, that may provide some other information that will be helpful to you and to others.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. If I can just have a comment, Madam Chair. I appreciate answering that question, and I do know that both Minneapolis and St. Paul are both struggling with their issues regarding full strength, where they're at. And that's been an ongoing issue for their budgets ever since, well, prior to the 2003 budgets when LGA was substantially decreased and hit, I know, Minneapolis and St. Paul particularly hard. And I do know that as we talk about this public safety issue, which is why I wanted to ask the commissioner and assistant commissioner, is because the vast majority, depending on the numbers you look at, 78% of public safety dollars are spent at the local level. And when those are going to be cut again this year, or presumably they will, and we see them cut substantially in the governor's proposed budget, I need to find out where that gap's going to be made up, because we've got some members here from the Urban Corps, but I guarantee you that stuff spills out into communities right quickly if we don't nip it in the bud in the core cities. I was gone this morning because I was at a trial downtown where a family member of mine was a victim in a brutal stabbing, rape, kidnapping, and the jury just went out. I assure you that our constituents look at public safety through those lenses. How are they going to be kept safe in that way? And then additionally, through the things that the Department of Public Safety can provide. And so that's why I'm hoping maybe the department can do that if the governor's proposing local government aid cuts. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative West. Further questions? Representative Bingham.
Thank you. I wanted to go back, Madam Chair. I wanted to go back to my questions about the joint programmings with the Department of Corrections. It wasn't answered whether you do like a performance-based comparison of whether MinCor does a better job or maybe one of the other programs through the Office of Justice can work better with job placement type and job training skills. The other question I have is, do you have any internal auditors that maybe look at the programming that you all do?
Assistant Commissioner Allison.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, we don't do a performance measure of the Department of Corrections comparing what we could do versus what they could do and whether it would be cost effective. You mentioned MinCor. I don't know that we would have anything that would be similar to MinCor. In terms of auditing, what we do with our grant programs is we have staff that conduct site visits and look at financial information as well as programmatic information to ensure that grantees are doing what they promised to do within that grant agreement that we have. We also have desk audits so that people are randomly chosen, particularly larger grantees that receive larger amounts of money, so that for a particular quarterly statement, quarterly bill that they submit to get reimbursed, they have to submit all of the backup documentation, all the receipts to justify the request that they're making to us financially. But primarily in terms of programmatic review, it really is site visits, people going out from our agency and visiting and seeing the program and talking to the staff and looking at what the activities are that are being performed.
Follow-up, Representative Van.
Okay.
I have some questions about the DCA. So, I'll just start, and then if you want to come to the table, if you need to answer. In looking at the budget book, we did find a key measure in the budget book. And one of the key measures was the amount of time that it takes to complete a case. And the goal is to increase the number of cases completed in less than 30 days from the actual of 58 in 04 to 75 in 05. Now, if you look at the budget book from that goal of 04, 05, and 05, you have the same goal in 08, 09, and in 09, 2010 and 2011. So the exact same numbers of going from 58 to 75%. Could you kind of talk about maybe your key measurements and where you are with that and why it would be the exact same goal from 04, 05 to 10 and 11?
Certainly, Madam Chair. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the Superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The reason it's the same measure is because we haven't achieved that goal. The turnaround time, as important as it is, it isn't the only objective of a lab. Certainly as important, in fact, probably more important, is the quality assurance that Deputy Commissioner Ellison mentioned a minute ago. It is important to get evidence turned around quickly, but it's more important to make sure we get it right. At the same time that we have instituted quality assurance measures to make sure that every piece of evidence, when it's analyzed, gets out, is done properly, we've also seen a 42% increase in the amount of evidence submitted over about a five-year period. So capacity deals with both supply and demand. We've had a much more demand, And at the same time, we've roughly held our own in terms of scientists, although in the last biennium, we did receive funding from the legislature for additional scientists, and we have increased the number of scientists. But even those, as we discussed last year, that can take up to, depending on the discipline, up to 18 months to maybe even 2 years before a person who is hired is actually productive. And not only aren't they productive during that anywhere from 9 months to 18 months or so, they're actually a drain on resources because other scientists who are productive need to train them. So it's a matter of staying caught up with things. But we have held our own roughly in turnaround time despite the fact that we've had such an increase in requests.
Commissioner O'Malley, I'm actually going to ask that you get me some additional information compared to what I have, because in looking at your website document on Accountability Minnesota, it actually states that the numbers are 56%, and then in the budget book it says that your actual number is 58%. So I just would like, you know, some clarification on what number it really is. If you could provide that for us in the future, that would be helpful. The other question that I have is, do you have other measures or target measures that you have that you could share with us so that then we could measure whether or not you actually meet the target? Again, the Department of Corrections provided a report to us so that we could at least see what the targets were and then measure whether or not they were meeting them. Do you have others that we could measure?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Are you talking about in the laboratory alone or throughout the BCA?
Throughout the BCA, through the laboratory, whatever you have, we are looking at what it is that we can look at to see what a great job you're doing.
Okay. Do you want me to describe that, Madam Chair? Do you want me to describe that now, or do you want it in writing?
If you have it and you know it now, please share it. And if not, if you could provide it for us in writing, that would be helpful.
Sure. I could talk, Madam Chair, about our three divisions and give you some of the highlights from some of the areas where we do measure. In particular, to measure how it is that we perform in light of the resources provided by the legislature. In investigations, a couple of examples. The Internet Crimes Against Children unit that was funded by the laboratory 2 years ago, they funded 9 positions. All those positions were quickly filled. We went from having no Internet Crimes Against Children task force to now the St. Paul Police Department has moved their unit in with the BCA, so we have partnered with them. We are handling hundreds of cyber tips. National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has there's a federal law that requires any internet providers who come across information on child pornography to report it to NCMEC, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, then provide those cyber tips out to the states. The BCA is a recipient of those for the state of Minnesota, so we handle all those. At the same time, we've done a number of proactive investigations. The ones you see on Dateline, where somebody's talking and pretending they're a child and meeting people, we do that also. As a specific measure, we went from 17 affiliates, they're referred to as, and those are local law enforcement agencies that were trained by the BCA and provided with some equipment so that they can then work the child pornography cases in their own area. There were 17 of those about a year and a half ago. Today there are 51. So we continue to reach out to those other communities so that the ability to investigate these. Really, the primary goal is the obvious one of saving a child. That's the number one. The secondary goal is to have a prosecutable case, though. So we try to do it in a smart way, where evidence obtained from a computer, statements taken, the online peer-to-peer discussions can all be captured in a way that they'll be admissible in court. We also have one of the positions that the legislature provided was an IT position. And we have taken that person and they have developed a system where we can now examine computers at a much more rapid pace than before. It used to take one analyst days to go through a computer. Now we have developed software and have someone who's worked this so that we can analyze several computers at once going at the same time. The next step is to try and establish a secure line between the BCA and all the other law enforcement agencies where the computer will come to the BCA and no longer does local law enforcement have to travel to the BCA to view the evidence. Instead, they'll have a way to look through the images that we've isolated on the computer. They can then do their report, take it to the prosecutor, and have a prosecutable case without having to drive to the Twin Cities from anywhere around Minnesota. That would save local law enforcement quite a bit. A second example is the Missing Persons Unidentified Dead Project from a few years ago. There was one-time money to the BCA to develop a database. If you recall, back in 2007, there were 800 missing persons in NCIC, the national database, that were there for over 30 days. With the funding, we established a database and set up a tickler system so that after 30 days, the BCA gets notified of those. We then contact local law enforcement. Of those 800 cases, 5 had DNA submitted. On the flip side of this issue of the missing persons are the unidentified dead in Minnesota, in the medical examiner's offices around the state and around the country. There are unidentified dead bodies. Don't know who they are. They've been there for anywhere from a few days to years or decades. A national initiative to use DNA, dental records, photos, and fingerprints. Get those 4 in there, 3 pure biometric measures and 1 the photo. Get those into a database of unidentified dead as best we can. Roll their prints, take their DNA, get it into a database, and then let the database search it. We took the money from here. We established the database in Minnesota. We linked in with the feds. There were 19 unidentified dead bodies listed in NCIC 2 years ago. We have now discovered there are 200 in the state of Minnesota. We're working with all medical examiners to get those 4 measures into the system. We have done that now, and in the past year, we've had 2 cases that have resulted in identifying persons who were missing from Minnesota. One was in Florida, a young girl that ran away in 1984. Never heard from again. Her parents never knew. We found out that she died of a drug overdose in Florida over 20 years ago. Florida had it as an unsolved case, didn't know what it was. So by using this database, that's a real clear benefit not only to that family, but if there was a crime, we might be able to solve some of those crimes. So that's an ongoing process. Again, that was one-time money. We have taken that on under our current budget to continue with it and continue doing that. The predatory offender registration units within the BCA is the one other one I'll mention in investigations before moving on to Mingus or Lab if you want me to. But that is, Deputy Commissioner mentioned the non-compliant rate. That's a very big deal. The non-compliant rate isn't just a number. There's a reason why we want that low. When the worst of all crimes occur and we need to find out who might be the most likely suspects, it is good to be able to identify them and talk to them quickly so that we can focus our energies on getting to the truth of what happened. We don't want to waste investigative time on people who did not commit a crime. And fairly often it's helpful to be able to talk to those who have committed the similar type crimes. This database is that we have is one of the best in the country. People travel from other states. I'm talking about the secure database, not the one that's out there, but the secure one. We can search by type of weapon used, by vehicle used, by location, by all these different things. So when something happens, we can look at the facts of that case. Little girls missing, little boys missing, whatever it might be, plug it in and quickly get to some of the likely suspects, talk to them. If there's 100 of them within 25 miles, 99 of them for sure had nothing to do with it. So we're better off finding them right away and moving on. The Drew Shedin case is actually a classic example of how this could work. Although a life was lost, and as tragic as that was, if we hadn't had the database that we have, and if it wasn't kept up the way it was, we may not have gotten to Rodriguez for a long, long time. Instead, within days, we had agents interviewing him, and he gave a bogus story of where he was at the time of this crime. He said he went to a movie, and we said, what movie? And he said what it was. If it took us 6 months to get to him, and I asked anybody in here, what movie did you see, or what were you doing on July 28th last year? You probably have no idea. If I said, what did you do Saturday? And you said you went to a movie, you ought to know what movie it is. He lied about that. That was the alibi was gone. We also got the hands in the car and got the DNA out of the trunk immediately. We've had cases where we can never find the cars that were used. So that's a good example of, although a life was lost, I think other lives were saved because we got to them quickly. So the DNA database, getting back to the statistics, in 2005, there was 11.5 was the non-compliant rate. As of a couple days ago, it's down to 6.2%. I think that's very impressive. It's the result of a number of things. One, a couple years ago, the legislature provided funding for us to hire 3 more agents. So we now have 3 additional predatory offender registration agents working with the locals that are going out working strictly on this to make sure that they're compliant. And if they're not, bring them into compliance or charge them with a crime. Secondly, the non-compliant website went up. We put that up so that if you're non-compliant, your face, your name, everything goes out on the web. So there's a strong incentive for those who are truly sincere about rehabilitation and have no intent to reoffend or anything like that to just be compliant. You're not going to be hassled, nothing will go wrong. But if there's some nefarious reason that they're not letting us know where they are, then their face is going to go up there in public and help us find it. Those are a couple of the main reasons that was brought around to the level that it is.
If I could ask a question about the suspense file as well.
Certainly.
A few years back, there was a large focus on the suspense file,
And I believe that there was a performance measure in rider language several years ago to say that you needed to do something about the suspense valve. Can you tell me how the suspense valve is doing and if there's a performance measure regarding that? Mr. O'Malley.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I wish I could have fed you that question. I appreciate it very much. When we first started looking at suspense in 1999, the average 50% of cases going into the database went into suspense. Fully half of the convictions were not being matched up accurately with arrest records and other problems like that. Today it's at 11.5% in about 8 years. It was right around 2000 when that was going on. I think that's a tremendous improvement. It's a combination of technology and business practices. It's a matter of working with local law enforcement and working with the courts. And it's been very successful in that regard, in terms of getting accurate information in. It also is helpful with the background investigations. When we get one now that is in suspense, we go and find out what it is and get the accurate information, go to the counties and get that turned around. Our goal there, by the way, is 10%. Is we're at 11.5%. We're not quite there.
Every time I don't fill out my offender data tracking form, I get in big trouble by my boss. And it's really irritating, and it started about 2 or 3 years ago, so thank you very much for that performance measure. I just wanted to tell you on the record.
Thank you.
It's happening.
Right.
One other, Madam Chair, one other item to mention on that. When we compare Minnesota to other states, as Commissioner Campion mentioned, I had a discussion very recently with my counterpart in another state and asked them how they handle their suspense issue. And his response was, we don't have a suspense issue. I said, well, what do you do when they don't match up? You have a court record that they say so-and-so's been convicted and either the SID number doesn't match or you don't have prints for the person. We throw it away. They just have no suspense problem. So the fact that we're even dealing with it, I think, is, not impressive. But there are a lot of states that just think they've got it all worked out. And, in fact, they're missing. If they were like us, and we were fairly scrupulous years ago, if they're like us, then maybe half of all their convictions are not being entered and not being people aren't being held accountable years down the road.
Further questions from members? All right. I have nothing further for you, Mr. O'Malley.
Okay.
Commissioner.
Yes, Madam Chair. I have one piece of just anecdotal evidence, if you will, that is based on nothing more than experience and just being around for a little while. A number of years ago, we, with regularity, had one of these horrific crimes against young women. A couple of them were mentioned here today, whether it was Larson down in Wasika, Drew Shadeen, any number of them. With regularity, it took place, they took place almost every other year. And there's the chronology of the last 10 years, and I mean, they're just some of the real horrific crimes. I don't know that we've seen those the last couple, 2-3 years, especially with the regularity and the violence and the horrific nature that took place in the past. I suggest two, again, anecdotal reasons for it, and really I give the legislature credit for this. One of them is our compliance rate for sex offenders. Again, that's just not a number that we think of some bureaucratic measurement of how well we're doing. Those are 93% of the 20,000 sex offenders that are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And the correlation between them being compliant with their registration requirements and them being compliant with the law, I think, is strong. If they're not compliant with the regulations to be a registered sex offender, one could infer that they're probably up to something that's no good. So the high compliance rate that we have, I think, is significant from a prevention standpoint. The second, I think, compelling event or occurrence that has taken place, and again, I'll give this legislature credit for, is the passage of the pseudofedrin law. There was a proliferation of methamphetamine made in garages and in fishing houses and in basements throughout the state that was absolutely out of control. The cost to local units of government, I think we figured at something like $120, $140 million a year, some astronomical figure for cleanup costs and all the costs related to cleaning up these methamphetamine labs. Is the methamphetamine coming from Mexico? Absolutely. Is it as strong, in my view, and as addicting as what's made in the garage and is cheap? No. Therefore, I think that the propensity to be addicted to methamphetamine in from homemade methamphetamine here in Minnesota is much stronger and has much more of a grip for and an influence on violence than that coming from Mexico and another country. So the combination of those two, really, frankly, legislative actions, I think, has been significant in preventing the proliferation of some very violent crimes and the proliferation of those horrific sex crimes against young women that we experienced for a long period of time. And again, as everyone here knows, it's very difficult sometimes to evaluate a prevention program. How do you evaluate something that doesn't occur? But I think that those two events are significant. I think they're impactful, and I think they've made Minnesota safer.
Thank you. Questions from members? All right, seeing none, Commissioner, it would be helpful if you could compile what measures you do have, what you use to measure whether or not your programming is successful, so that as the legislature moves forward in our priorities, we have something to look at from your department.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Ellison and I will get that for you, and I will accept responsibility. If we miscommunicated and there was an expectation that we were to have something different here today, I'll take responsibility for it. I was not aware of that, and certainly if that was the expectation, we would have fulfilled it.
That's fine. Thank you. Members, we need to approve the minutes. Representative West moves the adoption of both sets of minutes, February 12th. We met twice. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. This meeting is adjourned.